Thank you. So we coordinate a little bit with François. So François will give you more details. I'll try to keep it more kind of from a broader vantage point and try to discuss some things. Hopefully, as Richard was saying the other day, his talk aimed to be maximally offensive. I'm not trying to do that. I'm just trying to be maximally covering as far as there are many facets in the problem that will be interesting, but hopefully I'll mention something that you may be interested in. I'll tell you a little bit about my interests and the larger context. So of course, when LIGO was pitched to NSF, there was a whole laundry list of things that one wanted to or promised to try to go after. Of course, first was detection of gravitational waves and then try to infer things about black hole, neutron stars, say generic statements and then detailed statements about the population of compact objects, and even ask a question, provocative question, is anything beyond black holes and neutron stars as far as compact objects is concerned. Of course, there is a larger context of multi-messenger astronomy, and that goes in many ways, well, as many people have discussed, but well, you could imagine things like trigger searchers where the EM side informs the gravity side where to look and when to look or vice versa. But importantly, at the end of the day, complementary and supplementary information will come from this effort. And I try to argue as we go along that even for some of the most fundamental questions, we actually might need multi-messenger astronomy to actually fill in the gap, the missing information. One particular question we'd like to answer is, this gravity as describing general relativity? And the LIGO papers have already pushed in that regime, but as I'll try to say or argue a little bit here, there is so much that LIGO can do by itself. Of course, I mean, a very lofty goal is where we can go and try to get any hints of quantum gravity effects. That's a big if. And of course, any surprises that we might not have thought of. I'm going to summarize in very briefly lots of efforts. Essentially, there are 10 or 15 numerical relativity groups all through the world doing different work in all this on these fronts. I just can't do justice to everything that is being done, so I'm just going to keep it very small. I'm going to be giving you a very least a small subset of references, and it will be mainly restricted to GR-based studies. There is a whole bunch of effort as well on people kind of coming from the Newtonian side that also is very relevant, and in many regimes as far as adding the extra physics have been leading the way, but not having as good a GR control or gravity control might mean also some of the conclusions you're getting are not quite quite there. So just as to throw in some examples, this is an example of binary black hole simulations. This is for an equal mass binary merger, and by now you've seen this many times, but one thing I want to kind of draw attention to is just re-stress the point that the gravitational waves are very, very simple looking, monotonic, and if you just zoom in the merger epoch, this is what you see, where the gravitational wave has gone to its peak, and then you see the familiar or the expected, in between quotes, I'll stress, quasi-normal ringing of the black hole. But let me just contrast this observation with this. The difference between this system and that system, this is a black hole, neutron star system. The black hole had a spin of 0.5. The mass of this neutron star was 1.4, but it had a soft equation of state, so it has a relatively large radius. The star gets completely disrupted by the black hole. And well, first, there are much better waveforms. This is an old waveform. I like to put this out because this is one student with the work with me, and unfortunately passed away very shortly before the paper came out. So it had a few cycles, but the important thing I want to draw the attention to is notice there is a missing missing stage of the quasi-normal modes. So what happened here? Again, so this is in the context of LIGO trying to look at waveforms, and then all of a sudden not seeing the black hole ring down may not mean that we're not describing the situation with general relativity. It might just mean that the system is accreting matter. And as it accretes, because it does it incoherently out of phase, it shuts off completely the quasi-normal mode in a very interesting way. These are some waveforms obtained. Yes?
That's a neutron star system.
That's a black hole neutron star system.
So neutron stars star material is
It's just continuously falling in. It's being accreted by the black hole, and then that wipes out the quaternion mode. Of course, if what it enhances is in this sense. And if you have the neutron star just falling in whole into the black hole, so you have sufficient strongly perturb this field of the gravitational field of the isolated black hole, and that would be, it wouldn't enhance it, but it would be the maximum regime where you have the strongest quaternion mode.
So it's the issue here just that the accretion is axisymmetric, and so you so why does it shut off the quaternion?
Because it's raining, and then it generates another quaternion mode if you want, but it's completely out of phase from the standard, the previous one that has been excited, and then you just don't have any overall effect.
Well, so for this mass ratio, we would have expected to see a few cycles on that part?
Yes, this could have been, this was on a very early evolution, and now you can have many, many cycles here, right.
And it's not because the neutron star has disrupted before, it's definitely a
No, this is very clean here, and then, yeah. So this is now very, very well known. Yeah. So I just want to draw this point. The first spike. So here, what you're doing is just modifying. Which one? Upper left. Oh, this is. I can give you, that's just inconsistent. The data, the initial data, is consistent with general relativity, but it's inconsistent with the particular physical situation you're evolving with, right? Because you say, I'm going to put my two black holes here. You impose circularity of the orbit, but the orbit is non-circular. At that point, there should be something. So this is an artifact of the initial data, which if you see that plot here starts at 1,000, I took it out from this one. But if I had taken this one, I would have erased some of this, so I just kept it there. And all this as well. So there is always some initial transient that is artificial, but we understand that it's not affecting the dynamics. Say again?
In the second plot, what's the mass of the black hole?
This, the mass of the black hole, this was 7.5. There's a 5-to-1 mass ratio, if I recall correctly.
Just go back to Elliot's point on that bottom plot. So you actually get black hole neutron star systems, you actually get most of the information about the neutron star equation state from the kind of where it gets cut off. Don't get that much from the black hole dominates. You don't get that much EOS in the end spiral. You get, if you're doing EOS programming with the neutron star black hole, you get most of it from the end of the wave.
Yeah, I was going to stress that.
But you also get something, but not as much as you do in the neutron star case.
Yeah. Good. I thought I had a few slides, so we could just keep going. And so I'm going to throw my first exaggerated comment here, that in some sense, you could argue that all the waveforms are in control, but at different stages of readiness for production. So already, Duncan alluded that for the binary, and same thing as Alessandra, for the binary black hole case, all the templates in some sense are under control, provided you assume the aligned or anti-aligned configuration of spins. And if you now want to consider the generic case, in principle, the waveforms can be generated. They are costly, but there's the intense efforts in that front. And the moment you add matter, so the problem is that now the parameter space becomes much larger. What is the EOS that we're considering already introduces a whole bunch of extra degrees of complications into the problem. But if someone were to tell us, this is precisely the EOS, this is precisely the mass you expect, we could run it without any problem. The only corner, it depends what is it that you want to evolve and for how long and what is the thing. But in principle, everything except with the absolute mass, highest possible spins is in principle under control from a theorist's mind, so a theoretician's mind. So what is your counter argument? Right, right. So, exactly. So I was going to say something here. Exactly. No, and I'm going to make a point.
So the girls can't do it.
No, the ghosts, they can in, wait. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. My answer is absolutely they can do it. But can they do it in the right time, with the right accuracy, on the time scale that you care to have it? The answer is probably no. Because if you have a big enough computer, no, that's incorrect. Sorry, Alexander, you're answering from the context side of things, and that's not correct. So it is true that the spec code can do very accurate simulations, and they have to fight a lot to get the merger. But all the other codes just go through fine.
They cannot be that long, and we cannot just have 10 cycles.
Yeah, let's not discuss about codes. I'm gonna. Yeah, because they have to do something. They have a very complicated mesh structure, and there is some passage that have to go between right before merger two. But this is not where I'm going. So. Yeah. So, but I maintain that if enough effort is put, then any waveform can be obtained, almost anywhere. By an, the extreme mass ratio, the extreme high speeds. Right. Okay. So let me just go a little. Now I might not even cover the first few transparencies. So for a binary black hole, let me just. I want to stress this because it came out several times. There are three stages that we typically think of: the spiral, the merger, and the ring down. And you can kind of roughly separate it by the frequency, I'm going to call it the merger frequency, which actually is when the objects encounter the effective innermost stable circular orbit of the black hole they're going to form. And that you can obtain very simply. I mean, Duncan alluded that there is a way to obtain the final spin and final mass. There are tons of feats out there that you can get your hands on. There's another way of getting this from first principles that actually gets you a lot of the intuition of why is it that the waveforms for this look very simple, and it's precisely what I just said, that in many ways, if you think of doing a Taylor expansion, you can imagine the merger of two black holes as being described by a Taylor approximation of the final black hole ran backwards in time. And this is why there is such a thing, or one can understand such a thing of the innermost theory of circular orbits with respect to that final black hole. Say again? Oh, in the sense that I imagined I have a final solution that is a single black hole, and I want to understand what happened in its space-time when, if I were to run it backwards, prior to the two, when the two black holes are still distinct and they are coming together. So I can imagine doing a perturbative analysis of that space-time once you already have the black hole, and then try to understand how it got produced. No, but it's reversible with respect to the Taylor approximation. So I'm going to do a Taylor approximation on that. So rather than doing it constructively this way, I do it from that point of view. So if you want this work here, well, what it is, it's very simple. You say, well, the angular momentum of the final black hole has to be given by three contributions, the individual contributions of the two black holes, plus some orbital angular momentum. But of course, you have to say at what point it transitions from the two black holes into one. And that's where you say, well, it's the ISCO of the final black hole. And that gives you one equation to solve for, and essentially you get the spin. So that's basically what I'm saying. But the important thing is what we were saying during this program is that this frequency of the merger, well, it scales at 1/mass of the total mass, but also scales with the radius of the ISCO. And the important thing is that this radius of the ISCO can go from 1 to 6. People usually think of the 6 number because that's the number you get for Schwarzschild. But if you have the high spins, then this is actually 1. And this is what this ratio 1 over this to the 3/2, I mean, expands almost 2 orders of magnitude. So this is why the very, very high massive system, if you consider which would have a natural frequency of merger completely outside the LIGO band, if you now consider maximum spin, can gets pushed back into the LIGO frequency. So provided your whatever binary formation channel can have high spins, then LIGO already and high masses could exclude quite a bit by just not having seen anything. The energy radiated, well, it goes to from about 5% for equal mass non-spinning black holes to 12.5% if you again consider equal mass but extreme spinning black holes. And there are, this is, you can use these arguments to obtain that answer, but very high spinning simulations by Gisler et al. Already have pushed this number to 11.3, the actual simulations. So this is what I was saying before. You have to remember that this chirp mass knows about the total mass and the mass ratio. So this is good for binary black holes that differ, let's say, for significant in mass. But if you're thinking of binary neutron stars where the mass ratio might not be too large, it actually gets to be much more difficult to extract the mass ratio of the system. But here is where I'm going to step back and I just say, well, what else can we want to do, or do we want to do with gravitational waves? So far, the statement is that the spiral and merger behavior is quite consistent with the hypothesis of gravity being described by general relativity. And it has been tested so far through suitable parameterization. So when you get the full waveform, they are in the effective, in an analytical way that effectively captures everything, including the merger itself. There are some parameters that are fixed by comparison with full numerical simulations. But once you fix those parameters, you can also say play around with them and say, well, what if they are a bit different? And then check if those parameters are consistent with the ones you expect in general relativity or not once you compare with this, the observation. And this is what has been done. Eventually, one can think of trying to squeeze even more info if this, in the SNR side, because, for instance, in the case of quasi-normal mode ring down, all black holes ring in the same way, provided they have this, a given mass and a given spin. And one could, in principle, transfer or change one signal into another by just rescaling the frequency behavior. And so one could imagine doing kind of as the French did and define some standard meter where we can define a standard black hole of mass 10, spin 0.5. And then forcibly change the data stream and then try to do some sort of stacking. So this is an interesting idea that people are beginning to think about. But something that has been done recently by these people is to just take a look at the ring down characteristics of the merger and think, what if, let's imagine that object is not a black hole, it's something else. What would have been the properties of energy dissipation in that system of that putative object to be consistent with the decay rate, and anything that we know of, boson stars, gravitational stars, neutron stars, they all decay too slowly to be consistent with the observation. So again, it gives further support to the final object being a black hole. Just some warning, we already talked about this, well, the quasi normal modes might not be there, so depending on, again, what type of analysis one may want to do, the lack of quasi normal modes might not imply anything beyond general relativity. And also, some work that we've done recently, where we argue the gravitational field itself can go turbulent in the right regimes, might also then just change the spectra of how the final black hole will ring. So we have to be also aware of that. Beyond that, if you want to ask a question, yeah, that's there's a whole talk we can go. This is just too much fun, but we can discuss later. But what I can tell you is the following: in the if you imagine black hole perturbations, so typically the analysis of black hole perturbations at the linear regime. So if you do solve the linear problem, then you get this quasi-normal mode decay. If you ask what happens at second order. Well, second order, you actually reveal the presence of a parametric instability that preferentially rechannels some of that energy into some modes. And it's in doing so, it changes the spectra of that you would see the black hole ring down with. So it's just rather than having the main quasi-normal mode that you would have otherwise thought an EL2, M2 mode, there's a whole bunch of energy that ends up in the M equal 1 mode due to this parametric instability. Right, so very high. So now you ask, when will it turn on? And when will it turn on for sufficient amount of time for it to actually produce a very clearly observable evidence? That's for very, very high spins. For lower spins, it still would turn on, but the impact would be much, much reduced. So you may not. Well, it would be convenient to have a 0.998.
So, and that's 0.99 of the final black hole.
Of the final black hole.
So you that's two things fighting against you, right? Because you have a larger index and you have equal mass.
Right, but this is 0.9. This is 0.998 for a perturbation of strength 2%. So I can. You are now perturbing to order one if you want when you put two black holes. So I don't know. No, no, an unequal mass merger that has a black hole, that the primary black hole being having such a high spin is ideal. So this is a calculation we told you is that we gave explicit. It's the 2%, an object that has 2% the mass of the primary, and the primary having 0.998 will show this effect. So interesting one, this is something that actually we were chatting with Steve Giddings, and he has a paper on this. You can imagine, well, to what extent can gravity, can LIGO test differences that may arise through quantum gravity? Well, in some sense, we don't have a theory of quantum gravity to use and then try to obtain predictions, but we can use a different object like neutron stars of the same mass of binary black holes in binary neutron star system as proxies of an object that has further structure around the compact object. And again, as I'll show you in a minute, it's going to be difficult depending on the frequency depending on the masses involved and the length scale and the curvature scale where these effects might actually show. The neutron star as a proxy is an object that is sufficiently compact, because already LIGO has put quite a bit of an interesting constraint, right? Whatever the differences might be, it has to be such that the binary is not affecting significantly the binary, because the binary was as clean as you could imagine. So if anything, you're going to have an object that may have a halo around it, I mean some sort of wig around it that is effectively brought in by whatever, being say an alternative compact object or quantum gravity effects. And so those things can only affect so much. And so this is when I say, well, now imagine that you have a neutron star that has a compaction ratio of 0.2 or 0.3. So now imagine that it's now giving you a putative different black hole object. It's in a compact object with further structure. And then you ask, to what degree for the same mass can it begin to see this? But of course, we'd like to see whether there is anything beyond gravitational waves. So there, as you know, there are lots of speculations, and even more after some claims that we discuss. But I'm not going to get into it. But it's interesting to begin to think, maybe even quite outside the box, of what else could shine beyond just gravitational waves. And so something, let me just show you the movie here. So some interesting things to think about is whether you can argue that around the black holes that are merging, there might be ordered magnetic fields. If you do, even no spinning black holes could trigger something that we call kind of an extension of a Branford-Snyder effect. You can have luminosities that will just scale in this way, the energy in your magnetic field times the velocity at which these black holes are coming together. And as a reminder, the black holes near the point of merger, they are going at a very large fraction of the speed of light, 0.3, 0.5 c. And so you can have some luminosities that will scale this way.
So,
Right. So the picture is somehow something is providing some order field around the. Right. It's not in vacuum. Yeah. So if you don't have plasma, of course, nothing happens. There has been significant work assuming that there could be gas around the black holes. This was not done in the context of stellar mass black holes, but in the context of supermassive binary black holes. But again, if people are beginning to think outside the box and say maybe there is gas around, there are definite possible counterpart there, which of course are going to be very much tied to the merger itself, where that's when you have the highest flash. And interestingly, now that LIGO tells us that it could be black holes of mass, 30 solar masses of above, and discussions here of formation channels that actually could do that, it's interesting to consider where we can have some sort of Trojans. Because in the context of an electromagnetic counterpart, even if one can argue that gas and matter might be around it, it has to be around at the right time for when the merger takes place. And so if you actually have something like Trojans, you might have a binary with a high mass ratio, but the Lagrange points now are stable, and they could serve as herders of matter that will come in and be brought at the merger epoch at the right time. So this is an old result. If you have a binary with a sufficiently high mass ratio, so now the L4 and L5 Lagrange points are stable points, so you can accumulate matter there. And so this is seen in the solar system. You need to go above point Q above 24. But it's at the very least a cute idea to maybe look into it, and we're beginning to do something here. Yeah. So I have like 10 more transparencies. I'll just try to pick a few things here. But if you want to go really out there, if the spins, if binary black holes keep consistently showing low spins, at some point one might be even want to or have to start considering other options. And then the idea that black holes could interact with dark matter fields around that then through super radiance have their spin drain begins to be much more relevant. So I'm not going to say, let me just pick a few things. So if we think about binary neutron stars, the gravitational waves, as I showed in the first plot, are extremely different. I mean, these are different mass ratios, different equation states, and you can see them. However, this is what LIGO sees. So here is the light curve, the sensitivity curve for LIGO in a couple of different configurations. And for these waveforms that I showed, when do you see the difference? And you don't see them, you don't see them with this light curve. You begin to see them with this other light curve. And there's quite a bit of information here, which is going to be hard to dig out, unless it happens relatively close by. So LIGO has already, or people in the LIGO scientific collaboration have analyzed this, and they have come up with arguments or how many events you would need to actually begin to get this this information from tidal effects, and it comes to the order of dozens or even higher than that. So that's a very tall order. When will we get hundreds data points from binary mergers? That's going to be very interesting. However, as dynamics, we understand better the dynamics, we begin to see some other possibilities that might tell us more information. Of course, in binary stars, if the total mass of the system is above, let's say, 2.7 solar masses or thereabouts, the black hole promptly collapses to a black hole. The neutron star, the massive neutron star, hypermassive neutron star that gets formed as a result of merger promptly collapses to a black hole. And whether it does or not is very strongly EOS dependent, so that if we're lucky and we have such a system, we're going to have a very clear possible signal, because LIGO would have nothing else. Otherwise, there is a delay or no collapse. And that's important for possible counterparts. And very recently, we've begun to understand that there is an instability that grows another mode in the system that could become quite relevant. Because after a while, this mode can either overtake the strength associated or the strain associated to the M equal 2 mode. But most importantly, because this mode actually lies at half the frequency of the M equal 2 mode, at half the frequency, LIGO has a better sensitivity. So that's... So rather than sitting here, all the time sits somewhere there. So there is a possibility to go after it. The SNR is low, but the interesting thing is this is a detection, this is a search that would be triggered, because the detection would have already been made with the in-spiral, and one can go and systematically target specific frequencies, and those frequencies know about the equation of state, and they are largely independent of the mass ratio. So it seems to be an interesting possibility. But I'm going to put another caveat here. What if general relativity is not correct? Discrepancies may be introduced just by the gravity itself. And so this is an example of one possible theory. It's called scalar tensor theory. It doesn't matter with the details. What matters is that there is an extra field, an additional field that can take energy from the system. It can endow the stars with something else called scalar charge, and depending on the behavior of that scalar charge, you can have dipole radiation, and you can have kind of a renormalization of the neutron constant, which significantly changes the dynamics of the binary. So this is the gravitational waves near merger are totally different from those expected in general relativity. The rate of plunging or merging completely changes, but LIGO again might not see it, and if we don't resolve this degeneracy, we might misidentify this as an EOS effect when it actually could be an alternative gravity, which again tells us we need some sort of electromagnetic counterpart to add extra information. And one thing that we've been doing is to study what happens with magnetospheres that maybe are surrounding the neutron stars, and as they come together, they actually begin to push and kind of beat the magnetic fields into submissions, which then generate an interesting outgoing pointing flux. And the rate at which this pointing flux grows will be tied to the dynamical behavior of the system. So this could be an additional data point to try to see if what we're seeing is consistent with general relativity or not. No, these are not waveforms. Yes. That's a great question. So there are these radio pulsar observations have significantly constrained these theories. But there is, as we began studying the dynamics, turns out there is another phase transition that the system can undergo. And so you could have a system, exactly the ones that have been seen so far, they're completely consistent with general relativity, but as when they come together, they might completely change. There is a scalar polarization, but LIGO is not built to see that. So what you would see is, but interesting, you see some sort of missing energy.
That would be another reason to have more instruments on other places
of Earth. Oh, yes, absolutely. Anything would be more reason to have more detectors. Just another thing, I need to wrap up, but just to point some interesting possibilities. The other interesting thing, and there is quite a bit of work on this, is that we know when the neutron stars come together, if anyone is magnetized, there is so much energy in the collision itself. Again, the neutron stars are colliding to about 0.3 the speed of C. The energy, the collision is so violent that magnetic fields can transfer some of that energy into the magnetic fields, and the massive neutron star or hypermassive neutron star that gets formed would have fields going all the way to 10 to 16, 10 to 17 Gauss. How high is still a matter of debate, but there is no other saturation point that we can think of than the 10 to the 17 Gauss. And Andy and collaborators are also looking into that. So now imagine that neutron star that is extremely magnetized, is 10 to the 17 Gauss, and imagine that we're in the situation where it's going to form a black hole. So now you're going to collapse, you're going to release a lot of that energy. As the star is collapsing, angular momentum conservation will make it spin faster and faster. And so what happens with the field lines, you begin to twist them in a significant way. You put a lot of energy in these fields, a black hole form, and then you burst that out. So in principle, you can have tons of energy coming out. And so these are the estimates.
So what I don't understand is that if the field is really strong, why, it's going to couple to that, towards your ejecta, and it's just going to spin down
Well, it's affecting it to some degree, but not significantly. So the foot points know that the neutron star is collapsing, it's going a lot faster. The further points away begin to lag behind. I mean, I don't have a good answer to your question. I mean, these are full simulations of the system, and you actually compute what is the luminosity that you see, and it's huge. Where it comes out in some sort of interesting thing is another interesting question, because you can have so much baryon loading around that it might not be able to come out. But this is I want to throw it out as a possibility that typical calculations of possible, say, GRBs, or very strong bursts associated to the merger itself, have not gone into because we didn't have details for. Now we're beginning to see that there is some interesting amount of energy that is available for something interesting to happen. And I think the burden is on us to try to understand where this is useful for something. What did I want to say here? So let me just say two words about the ejecta, because, two words. So you're going to cover this. Four binary stars? Then I can jump. I'll jump. So let me just go last thing. So suppose black hole neutron stars, black, as we said, depending on the mass ratio and the spin or lack thereof of the black hole, we might have a system that just has the neutron star falling in. And how are we going to tell things apart? we won't have enough information from the gravitational waves. The gravitational waves will just be as binary black hole waveforms off for that same mass ratio. On the other hand, if we actually disrupt the star, there is quite a bit of information that will be in the gravitational waves, as Duncan already said, which is very convenient. In that case, if you disrupt the star, there is plenty of options for having an electromagnetic counterpart. But what if we are in the other situation? LIGO already told us, or is already hinting, that black holes could be large, have large masses, and we have a binary of large mass black holes. The chances of disrupting the star would be essentially be none. So how are we going to tell things apart? Especially if we've got not disrupting things, what else can there be there? And one interesting possibility, if it happens close enough, is that we actually have, going back to that movie I showed you before, kind of an extended Blanford-Snag effect. If you have a neutron star with its own magnetic field and the black hole, and that is going through the magnetic field of the star, it can power a jet. And this was alluded to in some of the papers, and some of us are doing simulations there. So again, it looks it's an interesting possibility to try to see how strong this effect could be and how low can detections of these systems on the electromagnetic counterpart can go to actually get a handle on this. Of course, the unfortunate thing is that it might not be very luminous. But on the other hand, LIGO would have told us where to look, and this is why the other day we're discussing if LIGO happens to have the analysis sufficiently fast to then tell, look, in about a minute or two, something might happen. Point there and try to see. Then one can imagine lowering the thresholds and then go after things like that. So there was a lot of things that I wanted to say, which I haven't said, and now this is the last one. I thought it was 11:15.
That's no, we need questions.
Oh, right, okay. So as I was saying all along, both detections and non-detections. I'm finished. What do you want? Well, I'll just stop here. Yeah. Yes. Correct.
These are introduced to hopefully with the idea that collapses don't produce black holes, but they produce fuzz balls, and therefore there's no information paradox. So to what extent can you take the data and in the simulations and distinguish between yes, it has a horizon, and no, it doesn't have a horizon?
Yeah, great question. To leading order, the answer is we don't know yet, because there is no theory that actually tells us something. Yeah, there is a framework that tells us a fastball would behave this way, but now when we don't have what is a good understanding of what is the effective classical metric we would live with. However, we can represent things in at least to some degree, right?
Well, people have essentially classical metrics about fields in the report.
Right.
They're like
holes,
but it's like they've got other multiples.
Yes. So what one could do, and there is there is some work starting that front, and the question is, will what is the quasi-normal spectra? It definitely, one would think, would actually be changed. To what degree will the change be significant that LIGO could see? That's a different question. It would be interesting to understand how the merger of these objects will behave. It probably will have a very complicated, very different pattern, but we're going there. I mean, there is a framework that we're introducing where you actually can capture, because you have to change things in such a way that you don't modify the effective in spiral that we've already seen, that is very constrained, but it actually knows that you have a different structure around the black hole, which is not a black hole. Yes, and I think we can, provided one has a significant SNR. And this is why, perhaps, if you don't have enough SNR, a collection of objects that should have, this is what I said, this stacking possibility. So if they are actually black holes in general relativity, we should be able to stack. And on the other hand, if the image, rather than getting sharper, gets more and more blurred, then it will be already telling us, well, this is not, doesn't look like a black hole in general relativity. But
sure.
stray?
I'm not familiar enough. I imagine there must be a crowd, otherwise it would be
So I want to know what is known about these fast boards.
You've thought a lot about the bus.
Sorry?
You say you've thought a lot about the bus.
No,
What is known?
What is known in the sense that you have
can you calculate the putting on the loads from second serving these things? Would might be, I mean,
yes,
so all into an n-spiral simulation is going to be challenging. But
because, for example, there have been a paper, and we discussed this on Monday, but there have been a paper where people have taken as an example wormhole. Okay, so if you're a wormhole, they show that the quasi normal structure is different because
the
potential.
It's a
toy model to show that if you have something which has no horizon, can you have a signal, the quasi normal mode part, which is different from what you have in GR, and how well you can see it.
I thought it was 45 minutes.
Because you have a example, and you can have the quasi normal there. Now, I'm asking, this solution you're talking about, do we have a metric?
There is an effective class of metric. No, because Steven is not thinking specifically of fast ball. Steven is saying, given the observation, you could imagine having an effective kind of weed around black holes that would depend on two things. One is the curvature scale, and the other one is the length scale. And he's trying to say, well, one example of that is a fast ball, another example of that would be a firewall. So he's just trying to be agnostic as to what would be the model. And then just trying to provoke what the structure might be that is consistent with the observation so far.
So I think we're going to come back to this specifically Monday afternoon.
I'll be here at 2.
Okay.
I don't
know. So let's thank Bruce again.